Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Time. It is 2089. An all-out nuclear war has killed two-thirds of the world's population. The Russians, who were able to get off many more of their missiles in a first strike, were victorious over the United States. Now in control of all of the world except China, they ruthlessly rule the People's World Socialist Republic. Place. Atomic bombs exploded all over the planet, but primarily in the United States. The U.S. lost 100 million people within 1 hour of the attack. Another 75 million died within a year. The Russians immediately moved in with massive transports of troops and weapons and quickly took control of much of the country. They built 40 fortresses in vital parts of the U.S., huge military complexes from which they send out search and destroy units of tanks and helicopters, and radiation-suited troops to extinguish the still-burning embers of resistance. The Russians use the American citizens as slave labor, forcing them to grow crops and work in factories. The Russian high command lives in luxury, the officers having taken the best housing in the remaining cities. The American workers must make do in shabby shanty towns around the fortress complexes. 35 million Americans are directly under the Red Rule. Sullen and docile, they carry out their Russian master's orders, but underneath, they hate them. They pray for the day when the legendary Ted Roczen, the ultimate American, will come with the free fighters of the hidden cities and release them from their bondage. Environment. The great number of bombs set off altered the Earth's axis. The polar caps began melting, and the forested regions turned to desert. The world is slowly warming, the higher amount of CO2 in the air creating a greenhouse effect. Lakes, rivers, and streams have dried up in many places. Ecology has almost been dealt a death blow from the war. 90% of the Earth's species of plants and animals are now extinct. The east coast of the United States is still extremely radioactive. Vast bare plains stretch hundreds of miles in New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, upon which nothing grows. At the edges of these hot zones are forests of mutated bushes and trees, covered with thorns and rock-hard bark. Parts of the Midwest were spared, as the Russians had plans for eventually using the farmland to grow crops for their own clamoring masses back home. But the soil is now too radioactive to grow anything but weeds. American slave labor was taken out by the truckload to work, turning the soil in the medium hot zones, meaning death within a year from handling the rocks and topsoil still hot enough to send a Geiger counter off the edge. The far west has been hit hard. Colorado was spared, mostly because of some bad aiming. But further on, in Utah, Nevada, California, there has been heavy damage. The area is now a misty, unknown land, inhabited by bizarre species of mutants and cannibals. Volcanoes and earthquakes have become common, and much of the Northwest has been turned into a nightmare of craters some miles wide. The South was hit in a haphazard fashion, as if the Russians hadn't quite known what to strike. Some states, for instance, New Mexico, Georgia, were almost untouched, while others, Florida and Texas, were blasted to bits. Parts of Florida were gone. Where Orlando and Tampa once stood was now a great jagged hydrogen bomb-created canal that stretched hundreds of miles across the interior, filled with a red, muddy water. Slowly, life tries to force its way back onto the surface of the ripped and savaged land. Many forests have expanded over the last century in areas that weren't hit. Great parts of the United States are now thick with brush and trees and resemble the country the way it looked in the 1800s. In other places, the deserts cover the earth for 400 or 500 miles in every direction. Unrelenting, broiling, hot, snake-filled, and cactus-dotted obstacles that stand between other living parts of the country. The Hidden Free Cities. Over 75 free American hidden towns have sprung up over the years. Located at the edges of hot zones, which the Russian troops are reluctant to enter, these towns, hidden in caves, mountains, deep wooded valleys, are made up of armed resistance fighters. Each free city consists of anywhere from 1,000 to 40,000 people. They are fiercely democratic, using town meetings to discuss and vote on all issues. The free Americans, who have been bred out in the country away from the Russian-dominated clean areas, have, through natural selection, become 10 times more resistant to radiation than their ancestors. They are bred tough, with children placed out in the 20 below zero nights. If the child lives, it is allowed to develop. If not, then it is just as well to put it out of its misery now. Ted Roxon fights out of Century City, one of the more advanced free cities, and the manufacturer of the Liberator automatic rifle, used by free fighters everywhere. They attack Russian convoys, blow up bridges, but they plan for the day when they can begin their all-out assault on the enslavers. The Russians. The United Socialist States of America is run by the red-faced, heavy-drinking General Zhabnov, headquartered in the White House, Washington, D.C., now called New Lenin. A bureaucrat, careful but not cunning, and a libertine, Zhabnov spends days eating and nights in bed with young American girls rounded up and drugged by his terror squads. Zhabnov has been appointed Supreme President of the U.S. for a 10-year period, largely because he is the nephew of the Russian Premier, Vasily. General Zhabnov rules America as his personal fiefdom. The only rules he must obey are that there be no uprisings, and 75% of the country's crops, grown by the enslaved American workers, must be sent to Russia. General Zhabnov believes that the situation in the U.S. is stable, that there are no American resistance forces to speak of, other than the few scattered groups that raid convoys from time to time. He sees his stay here as a happy interlude away from the power struggles back in the Kremlin. Colonel Kilov is the head of the KGB in the U.S., headquartered in Denver, Colorado. Thin, almost skeletal, with a long face, sunken cheekbones, and thin lips that spit words, his ultimate goal is to wrench power from the premier and take his place as ruler of the world. Colonel Kilov believes General Zhabnov to be a fool. Kilov knows that the American forces are growing stronger daily and forming a nationwide alliance to fight together. The comparatively calm days of the last century are about to end. From Moscow, Premier Vasily rules the world. Never has one man ruled so much territory. From the bottom of Africa to Siberia, from Paraguay to Canada, Russian armies are everywhere. A constant flow of supplies and medical goods is needed to keep the vast occupying armies alive. Russia herself did not go unscathed in the war. 24 American missiles reached the Soviet Union, wiping out Minsk, Odessa, Leningrad, and Volgograd. The rest of the U.S. strike was knocked out of the skies by Russian killer satellites that shot down beams of pure energy and picked them off like clay pigeons. Vasily is besieged on all sides by problems. His great empire is threatening to break up. Everywhere there are rebel attacks on Russian troops. In Europe, in Africa, in India, and especially in America. The forces of the resistance troops are growing larger and more sophisticated in their operations. Vasily is a highly intelligent and well-read man. He has devoured history books on other great leaders and the problems they faced. Advisors tell him to send in more forces and quickly crush the insurgents, but Vasily believes that to be a tremendous waste of manpower. If it goes on like this, he may have to use neutron bombs again. Order must be maintained, for Vasily knows his history. One thing that has been true since the dawn of time, wherever there has been a great empire, there has come a time when it began to crumble. Doomsday Warrior.
Should I blow the charge?
No. Wait until they're all on the bridge. Patience, Berger. Patience.
Ted Roxon, the commander of the 20-man excursion force of Free Fighters, looked toward Berger's detonation plunger. His icy eyes, one violet, one aquamarine, followed the wire as it ran 1,000 feet downhill through rocks and trees to a narrow steel girder bridge. The North Colorado River Bridge, as it had once been called, was now wired with 200 pounds of plastique slapped on in 2- and 3-pound mounds to the tops of all the supporting girders. A squad of heavy Russian tanks approached from the other side of the bridge, sending up clouds of dust above the parched, rutted road. Roxon hoisted his Liberator over his shoulder and walked to a large, flat boulder at the edge of the steep slope that dropped down the mountain to the bridge. With a powerful leap, he jumped 5 feet to the boulder's edge, and getting a hand grip, pulled himself quickly up. He stayed low, not breaking the horizon for Russian binoculars, took his own glasses out, then elbowed up to the edge of the boulder. The Free Fighters, hidden amidst the rocks, wore gray camouflage outfits, mountain boots with cleats, t-shirts, and flak vests already drenched with sweat. The 20-man attack force rested in the shadows created by the rocks, hiding from the noonday sun that beat down like the searing flames of a blast furnace. It had been overcast for weeks, but today, when clouds would be a blessing, of course they had vanished. The sky was clear, with only that strange purplish tint high in the atmosphere, hinting that anything was amiss with the world, that the heavens were radioactive. The Free Fighters adjusted their weapons, 9mm Liberator automatic rifles, and made sure no dirt was clogging the barrels. The mortarmen stacked rows of shells 10 to a pile and calculated the trajectory to the opposite bank. 30 feet to their left, 2 machine guns had been mounted, their 50mm muzzles painted brown to avoid any flashes of light that would signal the forward Russian scouts. Roxon watched the tanks move through a blanket of choking dust onto the ancient girder bridge, built in pre-war days. Watched the foot soldiers running alongside the steel killing machines. Watched the entire structure tremble and vibrate in protest as the first of the lumbering K-55s roared on. Rock watched and waited. He was calm, ready for the action that would begin momentarily. He had been doing this for a long time, killing Russians. Since he was a boy, it was nasty work, but not as nasty as the bastards had been to America. It was simple. The killing would stop when their occupation forces left. He focused his binoculars on the command tank that was just approaching the ramp to the bridge, and focused on the officer who directed the tank from the turret. The man was arrogant, with thin lips, a gold-braided collar, and that look of smug self-confidence that all the Russian officers had. Good. Let them think there is no danger. So much the easier. The column of 20 Russian K-55 tanks rumbled down the rusty road. The tanks moved slowly, spaced about 50 feet apart. They were surrounded by combat troops in full battle gear and radiation suits. The troops held onto the sides of the battle wagons, their thick anti-rad protective gear and heavy K-200 rifles weighing them down. Two of their columns had been attacked in this area in the past month. Though the damage had been minimal, the rebels had to be shown who was the power, the strength. This well-equipped force had 20 tanks, nearly 500 infantry, and a surprise package of 3 heavily armed helicopters, which flew several miles south, waiting for any attack, at which they would swoop in for the kill and wipe out whatever ragged forces these Americans had been able to assemble this time. From his rocky perch, Ted Roxon watched as the colonel's tank rumbled onto the girder bridge.
Ready, Berger? The span is almost full. After I fire, do it.
Who are you gonna take out?
The colonel. Who else?
Roxon swung the 9mm Liberator on its shoulder harness and made first target acquisition through the scope. The officer. The one with the braiding. Berger smiled, his thick lips curling back into his thick black beard. He leaned forward and pushed the plunger. The explosion literally ripped away the whole central support system for the bridge. Slowly, as if in a dream, it crumbled in pieces and headed for the water below. All the tanks and troops on the North Colorado River Bridge tumbled end over end, a bloody haze of shrapnel and flesh, into the rushing whitecap of the river. Within seconds, every Russian who had been crossing the structure was dead, sucked down into the dark waters. Pieces of flesh, legs pouring out blood, helmets, leather cushions to pad hard metal tank seats, all bobbed and twisted, a grisly dance of death in the cold brown water.
Perfect.
It's not done yet. The ones that weren't on the span are regrouping. Free fighters, take them out.
The mortarmen, Hoffman and Jones, began their work, aiming dead center at the line of remaining Russian tanks. The first shell fell about 30 feet to the left of the end tank. The next blew the turret right off the K-55. Only 2 Reds emerged, their clothes on fire. They leapt to the parched ground, running madly in circles, blazing torches of sizzling flesh. But the Russian tanks were closing in. Their sightmen were finding the free fighters' position.
Shit, that was close.
Lang, Croy, unload!
They almost got us to sights!
All right, free fighters, we're moving out. We've done our work.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about!
The guerrillas formed a semicircle around Roxon, loading their guns on their shoulders, folding up the machine guns, and quickly loading their supplies into thick canvas packs. Rox stood up to his full 6'3" of chiseled muscle and looked around at the assembled men. The streak of chalk white that ran down the middle of his head of jet black hair burned like a flame as the blazing sun beat down. His deeply tanned, rough-hewn, weathered face turned slowly to check out every one of the fighters under his command. He knew that he would be the one to bring back any dreaded news.
Everyone check yourselves for injuries. Anybody hurt?
The free fighters looked at one another and then down at their own bodies. No flesh was pierced, no blood was spilled.
Rock, you've been hit.
Detroit Green, a powerfully built black man, and Roxon's right-hand man, pointed to a large gash in Roxon's flak vest. He looked down. Something had reached him, some spinning piece of shrapnel looking for flesh to slash. He pulled the dirt-brown vest open and looked at his chest and stomach, then grinned. Nothing.
I'm the one always blasting all of you to wear these damn things. I'm glad I listened to my own orders. All right, let's get the hell out of here. Let the bastards blow up the whole mountain. Waste 10 tons of ammo before they realize we're not even here.
The mortarmen loaded up their prize howitzers in field packs, and sharing the weight with another free fighter, hefted the packs into the air and onto their shoulders, carrying the heavy weapons between them, their taut muscles straining.
McCoughlin, leave them a few surprises when they come to investigate up here.
With pleasure.
The jowled Scotsman quickly pulled 3 claymore sprayers out of his pack and placed them carefully around the perimeter of the clearing, clicking the arming devices into place and sprinkling grass and twigs over them.
Should be a nice birthday present for another 10 or 20 of our Russian guests.
The Free Fighters began leaving the plateau and heading down the opposite side of the mountain and its loose sliding rocks and pebbles. The thick green woods below beckoned them. Inside was safety, refuge.
Move, men! Move!
Most expensive rock demolition program in the history of the Soviet Empire.
He suddenly felt apprehensive. Why, he wasn't sure. Years of fighting the invader had sharpened his senses to a razor-honed edge of perception. Then he heard it.
Shit.
What?
Listen.
MS-18s.
They kept the air support hidden, waiting for us to get in the open. And here we are.